Call the Senate Interim Committee on Finance and Revenue to order. Welcome, everyone, to another legislative week. Today, we have a very interesting agenda, beginning with a work session for possible bill introduction, and we have a couple people here that will come up briefly to talk about some of the elements of the bill, but I will have Paul start with the LCs that we have in front of us.
Madam Chair, there are two LCs for possible introduction today, his committee bills. The first one is the most straightforward. It's LC 84. And what that does, it's a reconnect to the federal tax code. It would reconnect the state income tax base to federal tax law as of 12/31/09. There isn't any major changes between the May 1 collection or connection date you have now and 12/31, but there could be some issues that come up between now and the time you're ready to act in February. If there's not, we recommend that updating that, you know, the closest time feasible makes sense in terms of clarifying what the state's tax base is. Elements that were not connected to in your bill from last session, the bonus depreciation, for example, would not be connected to on this. So you'd maintain that disconnect in those areas that you specifically designated in the regular session. So that's LC 84.
Okay.
The other bill you have, other LC is 61. And LC 61 has three not directly related, the kind of indirectly related issues in it. The first is a timing and boundary change for property tax assessment purposes. The special districts have recommended that language change, and that's in the LC. There's a provision in there that exempts certain emergency equipment. They're owned by nonprofits in the LC 61 draft. And then finally, there's a clarification on property tax exemption for low-income housing for non-housing property that's connected to multiple housing units. So that's an issue that's come to you really from Multnomah County and the City of Portland. And further discussion of that is on your agenda.
Okay. Thank you, committee. And the issue about the emergency equipment was a new one to me. So we have Liz Wainwright here in the audience and Joan Buck, who can just come up and just very briefly explain what that piece of this LC is. Welcome.
Madam Chair, can I ask a question while we're waiting for? Are we going to discuss LC 84? Have testimony or
let's see, which one is that?
That's the big
That's
thick
the
one. The reconnect.
Oh, the reconnect. We hadn't planned to. It's just a vehicle to reconnect, but we can entertain.
I'll just have some questions.
Like.
Okay.
Welcome to the committee. If you could identify yourself, that'd be great.
Welcome. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Liz Wainwright. I'm the Executive Director for Maritime Fire and Safety Association, or as we call ourselves, MFSA. MFSA is a nonprofit organization based here in Oregon, founded back in 1982. And our goal, our purpose focus is to make enhanced firefighting equipment and training available to local fire agencies that expanded to include a communication, a VHF communication system, and then a master spill response for oil spill response equipment plan available on the Lower Columbia River and Willamette River to all the ships that transit the river. So that is our mission and our focus. It is we're funded by the local commercial vessels that call and the terminals that are based on the Columbia and Willamette River. This program was a voluntary program. It's not required by state law. Everyone agreed that it's good for the safety and the security of environmentally responsible for the Columbia River. So that's our focus. It is, we partner with the local fire agencies, and we also partner with the Oregon State Police as far as the communication system. The proposed language seeks to exempt the communication equipment, the emergency response equipment that we have, this will enable us to focus our assets on our mission of response and prevention.
Okay. And until relatively recently, you had enjoyed such an exemption,
yes,
correct?
Yes, we did.
All right. I just wanted that brief explanation because this
thank
was
you very much.
If you would, if there are any questions, thank you very much.
Great.
Thank you for coming down. Okay, I think what we'll do here is go ahead and have a motion, if we could, from... Oh, Senator Morse has disappeared. Well, no, let's hold on and have Senator Telfer raise your questions about...
I hate to be nitpicky on this, but as a CPA that does taxes, this is the first I've seen this document, so... I've not had a chance to read through it, but what are we not reconnecting to? If this is just reconnecting at 12:31,
Senator, let me have Chris come up, and we also have Kate Toswell here who drafted it. So I'll just have them come up to make sure they can tell you exactly what's in the LC.
Yeah.
The bottom line is what I really want to know is current code, what are we not connecting to?
Well, the
current code.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, with respect to what was done last session, the pieces that we were not connected to were Section 179, expensing, bonus depreciation, the one-time unemployment exemption, and then the
I believe it was in the debt.
It was a deferral. Yeah, the cancellation of debt.
Debt cancellation.
Yes. Debt cancellation. Now, the broader question of other issues that we might not be connected to, there are other issues that we were disconnected to before then. But in terms of the discussions in the 09 session and the bills that were passed in House Bill 2078 from 09, those four provisions were specifically disconnected from, and there was a general reconnect to May 1, 2009. Because we couldn't, that date of reconnect has to be a date in the past. It can't be going forward. And so this bill simply moves that May 1 date to 12/31/09 to align with most taxpayers' tax year.
Oh, question. So my understanding is we were not totally connected to everything before anyway. So we're not talking about those, and these are the only four items that we are not connecting, or we are still not connecting to under current code.
There are other provisions such as Medicare Part D subsidies that we're not connected to, the qualified production activities income. We disconnected in 03 or 05. So there are other provisions that were disconnected from that weren't part of an explicit discussion in 2009. So the question of all things that we're disconnected from is a little bit broader than the specific items that were discussed in 2009, the Medicare Part D and the domestic production activities being two examples that come to mind.
But we are connecting to the unemployment exclusion.
Right now we are...
No, with this. We are connecting to the 2400. Or not.
No.
That's not in federal...
If I may, Chair Bardick, members of the committee, Kate Toswell from Legislative Council, we are not connecting through this measure, but we are connected through other provisions. This measure would... essentially, its sole purpose is to move the date, the connection date, from May 1st of 2009 to December 31st of 2009, so continuing to establish a connection date that's in the past. This measure also, back in 2009, we established the idea that we would return to the rolling reconnect in 2 years. This measure does not affect that, but it does change the May 1st dates that we see in other sections that have been amended with applicability dates in 2011 to December 31st, 2009, so it's consistent across. But as far as changing any of the disconnected provisions, it doesn't affect those at all. Any of the provisions that were affected in spring of 2009 remain the same. The unemployment subtraction is a separate matter and isn't affected either way by this bill. There are a number of measures that taken as a whole, and also depending on what the outcome of the January 26th election is, result in state taxpayers having that same subtraction as is seen in the federal provision for the first $2,400 of unemployment compensation.
Okay. I think we're going to move on here just to remind the committee that the bill introductions do not indicate a support or opposition to the bill, giving us a vehicle to work with. So, Senator Morse, we have LC 61 and LC 84 before us, and I would appreciate a motion to introduce those as committee bills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move the adoption of LC 61, dated 1-8-10, and LC 84, dated 12-21-09, be adopted as committee bills.
Senator Morris has moved LC 61 and LC 84 be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Thank you. Okay, our next agenda item is on the business energy tax credit, a recurring theme in this committee. And we, Paul, do you want to introduce it?
I'm going to have Chris come up.
Okay. Chris will be up our guru on this today. Okay, do you want to just introduce this and then we'll get to our witnesses?
Sure, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We have the Department of Energy here to talk about a report that they put out at the end of 2009 relating to recommendations for the business energy tax credit. And then they also are going to talk through a legislative concept for proposed legislation for the February session.
Okay. Let's have our star witnesses come up. Mr. Long and anyone you want to bring.
It's me.
No one else would come, huh?
You have lots of friends in the back of the room,
really
though.
Afraid. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Long. I these days introduce myself as the director of the Betsy program, and in my spare time, I'm the director of the Department of Energy. What I'd like to do is walk through with you the report that we issued to the governor in late November, early December, and then discuss a legislative framework that we have been working on since that time. So hopefully you have a couple of handouts in front of you.
We
Is that
do.
Correct, the report itself?
Yes, we have the report and the summary here.
Great. And just, you know, kind of circling back from last meeting when I was here in about mid-November, we talked about the rules, and I think we have had a pretty good overview on the rules and the administrative and management steps that the agency was taking related to the governor's direction back in August and then again in November. We did issue the report. I think the clarifying piece is that this report and the recommendations that we're talking about are our initial recommendations that we did target for the February session. There is a significant amount of ongoing program review and analysis occurring, and of course we have our study that we're in the process of developing the RFP that will get out on the street here very quickly that will also provide more information. So I guess bottom line is this is kind of the first series of steps we're recommending, and I suspect that there will be and plan for many more to come as we move forward throughout past February and throughout the rest of the year. The report overall, I'm just going to touch on just some just high-level themes and then be happy to take any questions on the report itself and then go into the legislative discussion document that I handed out. The report overall, we wanted to get across that the BETSI program really is three distinct different programs or activities within the BETSI, and those are the conservation, the renewables area, and manufacturing. And we believe each of those activity areas or program areas has their own set of standards and outcomes and issues that need to be addressed. When we provided the report to the governor, when we looked at the BETSI program overall, we focused on the large drivers of both instability in the program and the complexity, and that's really the renewables area. It's roughly 65% of the BETSI program and is responsible for the large growth curve in the program over the period of time. In our report, we kind of capture that data and share that for you. So most of the things that I'm talking about will be related to the renewables program itself. Part of our other conclusions that we capture in the report that it's very difficult to conduct a state-by-state comparison with the amount of variability between the various programs, how they're implemented and administered. I think our staff identified 483 different types of comparison points between Oregon and states in the Western Grid, so we felt that that was very challenging. There's other factors that come into play, whether it's local conditions, policies, regulatory requirements, and other things. So we didn't spend a lot of time on exact state-by-state comparing Oregon to this state and that state because we didn't feel that it was apples to apples. Bottom line, we recommended a series of actions that we believe increase program accountability and move towards greater program stability. So with that, and I'll be happy to kind of move off of the report, and it's been out for some time. We have received feedback from stakeholders on an ongoing basis and other individuals since the report was issued back again in late November, and I'd be happy to kind of shift and focus more on the framework if that's okay, Madam Chair.
Please do.
Okay. On the framework piece, this is a two-page document. It's very high level, trying to encompass the areas that in working with the chair of both of the revenue committees and others, what we would recommend at the department level. And we've broken this document up into two pieces. Again, the accountability standards and then the stability measures. And then on the back page, there are really a series of decision points that we need to receive from the legislature on when and the time, how and the timing of some of the implementation points. I think the attractive piece of this framework is that you can plug in different components in the framework depending upon where you ultimately want to get, and it provides that level of flexibility. So I'll just start walking through these. Under the accountability standards, the best way to think about these are some of these recommendations we're asking to apply just kind of good common accountability sense for all projects that we have in the hopper, clear back from the beginning of the program. Some would apply maybe for some of the things that are in the process, and some of the things would be purely prospective in nature. And we kind of talk about breaking those up in the framework. So the performance standards for all projects at time of pre-certification and allowing the department to suspend, condition, deny, and revoke, and the clawback provisions would really be a prospective for applications that come in after you hopefully take action on our recommendations next month. Those things we've talked about for several meetings. The clawback provision is consistent with what we have currently in the manufacturing program, and we're asking for additional clarity within our statutory authority to make sure that we have the program standards and accountability going forward. We think that's necessary. Eliminating the practice of multiple applications for a project on item number 4, we've already taken that action administratively within the department. We adopted a series of rules on November 3rd that we walked the committee, the joint committee, through back in November. We're asking for that issue to be clarified and solidified in statute so that is an ongoing issue. Not specifically as the rules are laid out because we suspect there'll be modification as we learn more, but just the requirement that the agency set accept those standards through rule, which right now it's permissive. Eliminate the 10% cost overrun provision between pre-certification and final certification. We've done that again already administratively within the agency. The statute currently is permissive in that area, and we're asking you for to eliminate that discretionary requirement. So, again, that action we've already taken, but we'd like to get the statutory framework kind of solidified around those components. Allow the department to pierce the corporate veil if performance standards or conditions are not met, and if it ceases production and operations, and if there's money owed to the state. Some of these provisions are somewhat consistent with House Bill 2472 that was passed. We've added a component, and that's piercing the corporate veil, letting us look into the officers and project managers that may be involved in a particular failed Betsy project and making sure that we're aware of that and can take action if they come back into the system. We don't think that it's in the state's best interest or the public's best interest if we do have individuals or entities who have not met standards and have not used the state's money wisely to come back into the system kind of with a clean slate. So we'd like the ability to look at that, and that's fairly consistent with authorities I've used in other other regulatory responsibilities I've had. And then we're asking for the ability to look at not only maybe tax monies that are owed, which was contained in 2472, but debt owed to the state. We think that we ought to take a broad view of this issue, and that if a business or an individual owes the state money, that we ought to be able to find out about that and maybe hold back the Betsy the Betsy credit if there's money owed to the state. So we've broadened that up. That would include fees and fines and those kinds of things that occur within the state of Oregon now. And then the last component on here is the ability to expire the projects. Believe it or not, we don't have that in the statutory framework. So we have projects that are considered in the base of the impact of the program and data that we manage that go back to 1985. We don't think those are viable projects, and we don't think if they haven't gone forward yet, they probably aren't going to. And what we would like to do is establish a kind of a three-year time window between when we finally agree that project should move forward. We call that pre-certification. I'm not talking about application, because you'll hear from some that there can be delays between application submittal and when the state gives you that pre-certification green light, if you will, to go forward. We're talking about the time that we've worked everything out with the business, that business has been pre-certified by the state, indicating what the project is, various rates, conditions, requirements, performance standards, etc., and the time that they apply for final certification ought to be no more than 3 years. If they, for whatever reason, don't get their project done or need additional time, they can come back in and reapply and get that timeline extended. But we feel this is a pretty important measure, not only to look at some of the things that we have ongoing, but future, because I'm going to get into this. We're going to be recommending a program cap, and it's really important to keep things moving along and make sure that projects are indeed ready to go, that they have the necessary issues worked out, and that we're not just kind of sitting on things that aren't moving forward. Another component that I didn't actually capture in this piece that I should have, and I apologize for that, and we talked about it when we were here in November, is we do want additional ability to collect data on projects. We feel that in order to be responsive to you and to others, that we need to have good data on, you know, what actually happened, jobs produced, energy generated, again, focusing on the renewable area, some of the local conditions, other components that terms of operation and all those things, so that we can begin to give you and from the program standpoint manage the program a little bit better. And we don't have that ability now. We're starting to collect that, but we'd like you in the statutory construct to kind of shore that up.
You've summarized the framework, and let's stop here. And Senator Telfer had a question that I didn't want her to lose before we move on.
Yeah, I was just going to see if there's anything before I kind of go into
short-term memory is going. So thank you.
I hear you, sister.
Item number six,
sure.
Piercing the corporate veil. Mm-hmm. Do we have legal opinion on whether we can do that, number one? Number two, what happens to those corporations that are foreign in that they're another state doing business in Oregon. Can we, in fact, pierce that corporate veil?
Sure. Chair Burdick, Senator Telfler. On the second question, I'm not sure. We haven't asked that particular question. But on the first one, we do believe we have the if you give us that authority, we believe that that is something that you could put into a bill that could pass. Yes.
Follow up. Yeah. When you say we believe, do we have legal opinion on that says we can, in fact, pierce the corporate veil?
Chair Burdick, Senator Telfler, we've worked with our own internal staff and our DOJ. I don't have anything formally, but we've also worked with your staff in legislative council and had discussions around this framework, and no issues came up during those discussions.
We do have Kate Toswell here, who's back in the room, who might be able to elaborate on that. On the matter of piercing the corporate veil, Senator Telfer's question was whether that would stand up legally. Do you want to come up, Kate, and just address that briefly?
Kate probably hasn't drafted the language yet.
Yeah. And foreign corps and foreign corporations doing business in Oregon.
This draft actually isn't prepared yet, but I wasn't in the room for the question.
Can we go and introduce yourself, and then we'll have Senator Telfer repeat
Chair Burdick,
the question.
Members of the committee, Kate Toswell, Office of Legislative Counsel.
I'll just get her up to speed real quick. It's this component about piercing the corporate veil and kind of looking back at the different officers and whatnot, and if there was a problem one place and another. And I know we had that discussion. And
we actually did meet a couple of weeks ago about some of these proposals, and as far as we know, we haven't actually drafted it yet, but we don't foresee any obstacles.
Even with a foreign corporation doing business in Oregon, foreign meaning another state.
Exactly.
We can pierce that corporate veil even though it's not, the articles haven't been filed in Oregon.
Senator Telfer, members of the committee, we did not actually discuss the issue of corporations not incorporated in the state, but that is certainly something we can explore.
Okay.
As the language starts to come together for the concept, for the committee's concept.
Yeah, if you could put that on the list, that's a good question that, frankly, hadn't occurred to me. Do you want to follow up?
Okay,
thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morris, or Senator Rosenberg?
Thank you. My question is, so that we're all on the same page, could you define piercing the corporate veil?
Chair Burdick and Senator Morris, I want to be fair to counsel here because we've met and discussed a variety of the policy framework and kind of identified which issues, because there was broad discussion, were problematic and what we thought were doable. The list that I've shared with you are doable, but we haven't sat down and done the formal drafting. I hate to put the staff on place. This is an idea that, again, in my regulatory role, which I know you're familiar with, we've captured this authority in two agencies previously on things that I've worked on, and believe that this is a type of thing we can work on the Betsy if, as the drafters get further into it and find out that there's either mechanical or legal problems, I'm sure they'll circle back with us and we'll kind of walk through that. But we think the idea, the concept and there are examples of individuals involved in projects who maybe receive payment from the state of Oregon and don't fulfill their obligations. We think from a matter of policy, we ought to be able to look at that and determine if we allow that person back into the system. This is an incentive program, and to be able to look at that individual, maybe place additional conditions or protect the state better to make sure that we don't have a repeat occurrence of what happened before. And if I'm off base, I'll be happy to circle back. But that's kind of where we're at.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. The idea of piercing the corporate veil is that you lose the corporate shield and individuals assume that liability. But that's my definition of piercing the corporate veil.
Okay, we've used a generic term then for what we're trying to accomplish here. We're simply trying to, Chair Burdick, Senator Morris, we're simply trying to, if you or other, not you personally, but if folks were involved in a project under one particular entity name, they come back in under a new name, act as though that's a brand new set of circumstances, this thing never happened before, we ought to be able to take a look at that and see if the same folks are involved in that. Not talking about changing any of their corporate protections or other arrangements. We just want to be able to kind of trace individuals that may have a problem, a pattern of problems in fulfilling their obligations under this particular program.
Thank you for that explanation, because red flags were going like this.
Yeah, but that's a good point. That. We're not we're not trying to assign liability. We are trying to just assign a lack of qualification for additional.
Right. You might want to choose a different
reference. We're already mentally going through that exercise right now. Maybe a better way is our ability to identify bad actors and track those bad actors, no matter how they've organized themselves.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. And thank you for bringing up your business expertise on that, Senator Morris. Senator Rosenbaum,
yeah,
do you have a question?
Yeah, I think I'm reluctant to let go of that phrase, because I think when this turns into the movie version of the bill, it just has to be in there. So I just wanted to ask about number 7 on here, the expiration date of 3 years. So does that indicate that all projects need to be completed within 3 years then?
Chair Burdick, Senator Rosenbaum, what we're asking for, again, if you kind of think about our world, an individual applies to us and 30, 60, hopefully not more than 90 or 120 days go by before they're given the green, they apply before the project starts. And then when we feel comfortable with the project and all the conditions and performance standards and have determined whether there's bad actors, et cetera, involved in this particular project, we issue a pre-certification, which is your green light to go. And generally, we're the kind of the last stop. Hopefully, a bunch of the other permitting and finance issues have already been worked out or in the process of it. We'd like that project then, from that standpoint, for them to apply for their final certification. So in a nutshell, yes, the project would be completed. And we see that most of the projects in the BETC program overall are completed within that time frame. We think that if it can't, or you need to come back in, that we should open that up where you come back into the system. But we believe that you should reapply, and there may be new standards, there may be requirements that you'll have to meet, but we don't think that that should be something that should be ongoing. And we've talked an awful lot about discretion for extensions and those kinds of things. And just as though there's a discretion for the 10% cost overrun provision, we found that that became more of a norm than a discretion, and we'd like the ability to kind of start and close that so that we can keep projects moving. So, long-winded response, but the short answer is yes, we'd like to get those projects up and going in that 3-year period. Now, again, I'm talking about renewables here. If we were to get into the manufacturing area, we would need to have a different time line, because those conditions are quite a bit different.
So just to follow up, and I don't mean to hammer on what's just a general description, but
sure.
So is this saying that from the date of pre-certification, there will be a 3-year period to when the project has to have begun or when the project has to have been completed?
Chair Burdick, Senator Rosenbaum, be completed, where they have to apply for final, which means they've completed their project under that pre-certification.
Okay. Thanks.
Yes. Madam Chair. And again, we have projects, we have many projects now back to 1985, and I want to be very careful, because this is not the norm, but there are entities who try to get their project kind of in the queue and may not have any intention of going forward within a timely period, and we definitely do not want to incent that type of behavior, so if it occurs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned jobs a few places here, and I know this isn't specifically a jobs program, but what will the language look like to tie jobs to projects, if at all? I'm not sure the state can afford these, subsidies of $30 million in which there's 30 jobs there. And so what would the language look like there, and what is the policy framework around the goals that you would set?
Sure. Chair Burdick, Senator Haas, I probably need to clarify. We would simply ask for the information and or basically take the approach that if you come forward with a project request to the agency and you indicate that I'm going to provide 10 jobs, 20 jobs, 30 jobs, whatever the number is, 5, that's part of the negotiation of that pre-certification, and I'm going to generate X kilowatts or megawatts of energy, and I'm going to operate for at least 5 years, hopefully longer, and I'm going to do these other things within the community. Whatever that overall package is, we're talking about getting those clarified in that pre-certification, setting those elements as conditions, and then being able to hold you accountable. We're not talking about establishing a jobs per megawatt or kilowatt or a jobs per certificate level benchmark, because I think that would be awfully difficult. When we, the best example is in our manufacturing. When we work with the manufacturing facilities, we have independent performance standards and third-party evaluations to look at the plan, at the finance plan and the production plan, and then we get that all spelled out in a conditional document. And then because you gave us clawback ability, I believe it was in 08, we can actually go back and capture monies that the state has paid out or stop monies from going forward. And that's really what we're talking about doing in the renewable area, but not a specific connection, because it's unfortunately too variable, and it's kind of project by project.
But they just have to do what they say.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate it. And that's a tough one, policy-wise, just whether to tie it there. I realize that you have to be flexible. A different issue, transferability, which we've talked about a lot in this committee.
Mm-hmm.
Will anything in this new legislation deal with investors being able to buy at discount these tax credits, or is there a way to take some of that money off the table that the state is losing just simply because of the process?
Sure. We are not, Chair Burdick, Senator Haas, for our proposal in the report and then this framework, we have not recommended any changes to the, I believe you're referring to kind of pass-through or mm-hmm. third-party purchasing of the tax credit, however you want to look at that. We're not recommending any changes for February. Obviously, pass-through is on our list of things we're continuing to review, both in the study and internally. You may or may not be aware, last Friday, I adopted rules as a result of House Bill 2067, I think. I can't remember if it's 2067 or 2068, that you passed in the 09 session, where I changed the methodology of the pass-through rate and have moved to a tiered approach for pass-through. And I guess I would like the flexibility for this first quarter, which is when this goes into effect, to kind of monitor and evaluate that approach. And I'll just share with you briefly. It's not necessarily part of the legislative framework, but you need to be aware of all the administrative things that we're doing and then how that all connects to the statutory recommendations we're making or legislative recommendations. I'm going to talk very generically, but essentially the annualized rate of return on the pass-through program under the old rules before January 1st was around 9.5%. We've moved that number to 7.2, I believe, 7.5, somewhere in the 7% range. So we've lowered that, which will put more money into the projects itself. It reduces the amount that's going to that third-party entity. And what we've done is we said that's the rate for a project that is in the manufacturing sector and a project that has that's for a public building or a public entity or a tribal government. The rate for all other types of project is moving, I believe, between the 4.5% and 5% rate on an annualized basis. I can get you the details. I'm going off the top of my head here. So we've taken a whole different approach, and this is the first time that I've been aware that the department has looked at a tiered approach and a prioritization approach for the pass-through, basically identifying different rates of return based on analysis and feedback through the hearing process for different types of projects. And we want to see how that works. That's in effect for the first quarter, and then we're required to come back and kind of reassess that methodology. We've tied the rate to the market, I believe the five-year Treasury bill, with some consumer price index factors to set those rates. So I guess with your indulgence, I'd like the ability to kind of see how that goes, because there may be problems. It may be too high. It may be too low. We may not have hit the right policy outcomes, and we'll know pretty quickly as we see how the market reacts.
Madam Chair, I do appreciate that. I'm glad you're going that direction. I still don't understand then how we had some of those 30-35% discounts in the past.
Well, again, I gave an annualized number, so most of the Betsy programs on, I'm sorry, Chair Burdick, Senator Haas, The Betsy program is a five-year program, and they take the, I'd have to get somebody up here that's a little bit better than I am on the numbers, but essentially it's a five-year program, and so when you factor that out and when they take it, you get an annualized rate, which I think is easier to kind of talk about in for me, frankly, and in a general setting of kind of comparing apples to apples.
So by moving from the nine-something to the seven-something,
I put more money into the
what
project.
What does that do to the 35%? Does that bring that down to, like, 29%. I think that's the number you were looking for.
I don't know off the top of my head.
We've got
24,
Andrea.
25. Chris, I don't know if you've looked. You probably haven't looked at this.
Senator Morris?
Just to respond to Senator Hassett.
Yeah.
Question. It's a present value calculation. A dollar 5 years out is not worth a dollar today.
Right.
So it gets
it's very simple. It's what's the discount rate that you're going to use, and what you're doing is lowering that discount rate.
Yeah.
Is that correct, Chris?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
But the effect of it is to reduce the amount that's being given to the project up front.
The effect is to, you know, and we obviously, what we believe, Chair Burdick, is experience has told us that a one-size-fits-all approach may not be the best policy outcome for the state. And secondly, we need to tie it to a market factor, which we've done. And third, that we're trying to get as much money of the state's money into the actual project but still making this some type of a mechanism to get money into the project up front, which is what this is about, viable and ongoing. So that is it's easy to say here, but it's very complicated back at the agency to try to factor that through. So, again, we're not recommending any changes to not only the framework or the rates until we can get through what we've just done administratively as a result of legislation that you passed. But we do and have flagged pass-through as a general thing that probably needs to continue the discussion for 011.
And we will be continuing this discussion as a committee in 2011 and may actually begin it in the February session. I had a question on your last point that you added on the ability to collect data on projects. Has there been any discussion of trying to get some kind of data on the internal rate of return for some of these things after all the subsidies are added, and where the Betsy fits in terms of the investor's kind of threshold for a go or a no-go internal rate of return?
Chair Burdick, there's a built-in tension to how much data the business community is going to want to provide to the agency, and then what would be subject to public disclosure. And so if you get into, you know, rates of return, whether, you know, rates on capital investment versus ongoing, I think we have to be pretty sensitive to the needs of the individual project investors and businesses, and talk about how much of that is useful to the state, and we haven't determined that yet. And then, frankly, what do you do with that data, and then what becomes available in the public domain? Because what you may not be aware of, and well, you probably are, because we've all been reading the newspapers, is currently everything that I collect is available. And so I think that I would jeopardize projects if I went too far, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So
there's
a built-in tension there that we need to kind of think through.
And I think this is probably an issue that comes up with the Public Utility Commission, and when we authorized this study, we deliberately put the PUC into the mix. And so I would just want to urge you to look into that and look for a structure. I mean, Senator Morris and I on a work group learned early on in the project that there had actually been a couple of Betsys that had to be reduced at the very end, because to give the full Betsy would have been to make these subsidies exceed
the project,
the cost of the whole project.
We don't want to be in that situation.
All the subsidies. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to get to the point where, you know, the Oregon taxpayer is not in charge of, you know, over-subsidizing some of these projects. You know, we want to encourage something to occur that wouldn't otherwise occur. But to subsidize a project so that, you know, out-of-state energy buyers can have lower rates is not what we have in mind. It's certainly not what I have in mind. I don't think anybody on this committee. as the purpose of this project. So, but in order to kind of reach those, to find the sweet spot, as it were, for the Betsy credit, you really have to have the data.
That's absolutely right. And I guess, Chair Burdick, I would concur with your thoughts. We don't believe that the Betsy program should obviously fund projects in excess of the project costs, nor be part of ongoing operations of a business for indefinitely. And so, as you know, we're making sure that those types of situations don't occur within the program. As far as the data goes, again, we are looking at it. There are there are basic core pieces that we want to ask for, and then the broader questions would be very useful to the agency in answering those questions. But we kind of have to think through, you know, what do we ask for, and how does that work within the development and within the project community, because, again, I think at some level that would be problematic to competitors and other entities.
Right, and we want to be
so
respectful of that,
yeah.
But we also want to be guardians of the Oregon taxpayer.
Yep, that's why I said there's a built-in tension there that's
right.
Challenging to.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morris.
Thank you. This raises a very glaring gap in public policy, because we have an industry that for non-renewable, you know, theoretically, including hydro, you know, it's a regulated industry and it's an open book. And in the non-renewable or a renewable side of it, it's a closed book. But yet we're in a regulated industry and you have monopolies, essentially. So that's why you have that regulation. And I think we as a body need to come to grips with what is regulated and what is not regulated. And I think we've seen the excesses in this plan when you have, you know, non-regulated for purposes other than essentially utility production and distribution of energy. There's a policy gap here that we need to come to grips with and identify so that we can actually operate in the best interest of the consumer and not in the best interests of investors. But it has to be a balance.
Yeah.
And that's why you have the PUC, and we're out of balance.
I don't disagree.
Thank you. Well said, Senator Morris. That's what I meant to say. And if we can get into any more clarity in the study on that, that would be very useful.
Well, Madam Chair, both here and then everywhere that I go, we continue to identify issues that need to be resolved, and I'm not dismissing or suggesting that we shouldn't address them. What we provided you is a framework of things that we feel are a good starting place, not the end of the discussion. So to address with the immediate accountability and program stability issues that we're seeing. Would you like me to continue on?
Please do, unless we have other questions on this section. Thank you.
Sure. So on the second page, the six items are really the program stability measures, and this is kind of where we believe a significant amount of policy decisions need to be made around amounts and implementation dates. And I'll walk you through this. This framework was contained within the report itself, and we are recommending a program cap for the renewables activity within the Betsy program. Again, renewables being the large driver, and having those challenges that Senator Morris has talked about and a whole bunch of other complex issues that we don't see in the other two activity areas at the same level or degree. What's important to note is the cap would establish the maximum amount of pre-certifications we would do in a biennium. And so the best way to think about that is if I pre-certify $10 today, which would be in this biennium, remember that tax credit is taken over a 5-year period and can be extended up to 8 years. So there's a kind of a 13-year window of when that will start coming into hitting the general fund. It's statutorily broken up over the 5-year period, but again, it can be extended. So $10 done today is not $10 in current budget. It's $10 that I've obligated to the state, if you will, over a period of time that, again, assuming the project is goes forward and meets all the performance standards, we don't have any other kind of regulatory accountability issues, we would pay that $10. The question is when does it occur? So we cannot dictate when that comes in. We do our best work with staff to try to model what we think will happen, and that's when we provide your estimates. But what we're talking about, and it doesn't exist currently, is setting a cap for the amount that we would approve on a pre-certification basis, which would be what I call the net amount that's going to impact the state at some point down the road, and setting that amount for a biennial level. We, in the report, we recommend that that cap be tied to energy activity in Oregon. We actually have that data, and we collect that data on an annualized basis. We looked at indexing to a variety of different things, and in the report, we recommended the energy activity. And just to kind of, and in the report, we recommend a 1% index to a 4% index, and that's roughly speaking, $75 million to $300 million is kind of the range there. Again, this is in the renewable area, and I can't stress enough, and hopefully Chris can help me with this as necessary. That's an amount that we would pre-certify. You cannot factor that amount as far as what's going to actually occur that particular budget cycle, because we don't know when that project is going to occur. If you establish a cap, and we don't have one now, you need to be able to prioritize the projects, and we don't have that ability now, and we would need you to give me that ability. So if you set a cap at a particular number, and you'll see that we've left the numbers open for a decision point, we would need the ability on a quarterly basis or whatever to say, you know, collect projects and prioritize based on a set of factors to consider. We have not worked out that detail yet. Chair Burdick and Chair Barnhart on the House side asked staff last week, I believe, to kind of go back and figure out what that criteria would look like and how we would operate under a cap. And we've just looked at, you know, infrastructure connection issues, readiness, environmental, jobs, return on investment, power generated, produced, saved, et cetera, those kinds of things, and then making sure that we don't end up with a situation where a large project, that you don't have equalization between your large and small projects and local and utility versus distributed scale, and that you phase so that you don't get into a situation where, I'm just making this up, but within the first 3 or 4 months of the biennium, you're not approving projects anymore. So we recommend a cap as a way to help program stability, and a set of criteria factors be established so that the agency can prioritize within the application pool what goes forward within a biennium. Before I move on, I suspect there's probably a fair amount of questions around this. I usually get those when I talk
about it. Actually, that's probably a good point to open up for questions. The cap is the way you have it structured with prioritizing it has a lot of potential, because you could, you know, from the taxpayer's perspective, you could, instead of just giving it the money to any project that qualifies, you can really single out those ones that are just the
high performance,
the
yeah.
high performers, and focus your money on that. You can also, as I understand what you're proposing, you could also fiddle around within the cap to have, you know, a mix of large projects, small projects, so that some of the smaller projects wouldn't just kind of get left in the dust.
That's absolutely right, Chair Burdick. And so obviously we need to work on kind of the legislative framework of how that would work, and then some of the details and the factors to consider. But again, on the stability side, we're recommending a cap for the renewables area to kind of take the growth swing that we've seen and kind of flatten that out a little bit, provide a little bit more stability. I think you could get to a point of, Chris can correct me on this, but kind of forecasting program impact would be a little easier, I would suspect, down the road, and that you would then, a positive thing would be the quality or high-performance projects would hopefully rise to the top out of that process.
Yeah, and for the challenge, of course, in anything like this will be a time versus quality, because if you have a whole bunch of projects that come in looking really, really good in the first 4 months, it's a real balance. So that's going to be one of the challenges, committee, is to try to figure out how to allocate the timing of this cap so that somebody coming in with just a fabulous project, you know, two-thirds of the way through the biennium will still have a chance.
Yeah, I think you'd have to, Chair Burke, I think you'd have to look at kind of quarterly or some kind of phased amounts and then working within that area. Folks that have been in the agency longer than I have shared with me that there used to be a cap years ago, and by May of the year, it was an annual, and by May of the year they would reach the cap and be done. It was kind of first in, first out. You didn't have the interest or the need that we have currently, and then they would just not process applications and start all over. That's not something that we're recommending, because we think that that creates uncertainty to projects. And I guess one of the main things that we're talking about, what's been important to the state in looking at this program, is, you know, we've developed there are some issues that we need to address, and we tend to focus on the bad actors, if you will. But there's been a significant amount of quality projects, and we've built up a pretty robust infrastructure using this program and other policies that have been adopted over the year in the state. And we certainly want to kind of keep those going. We want to keep the small businesses that have gotten into this field and are providing conservation or renewable measures within their communities. We want to kind of keep that level going. We want to keep the infrastructure. We really don't think it would be in the state's best interest to see sharp on and off kind of switches related to this program, because I think you'd lose all the investment and all the infrastructure that you've built up and have a pretty good impact on all sizes of businesses. So we think a cap, and if you break it up quarterly and create factors, that's a way to kind of keep it going, and you have some certainty of what's happening. We do, and it will be difficult to transition to. I'm not suggesting this is an easy thing to administer, but we think this is at least for February, if you choose to accept this recommendation, something that we could then get implemented the remainder of this biennium.
Other questions on this? Senator
Rosenberg. So I just have kind of a straightforward numbers question, unusual coming from me. But on page 19 of the big handout, table R3, could Chris or Mark, one of you, explain what the term gross operating revenues means, and then where do these figures come from?
Sure. So, Chair Burdick, Senator Rosenbaum, page 19 is an overview of what we call the ESA, and it's data that we collect. Just so that you know, a part of the agency, we're funded through three broad revenue sources: federal, fee-for-service. Betsy program is fee-for-service, as an example, and then what we call the ESA, the Energy Supplier Assessment, and we assess to all entities transmitting, I gotta make sure I get this right, distributing, generating, and supplying energy in Oregon. And we receive the operating revenue from the however many companies and entities there are involved in that in our sector in Oregon. We receive that information on an annual basis, and the purpose of it is for us to determine how you fund the agency. What we thought is that's a pretty good reflection of energy activity, because gross operating activity of all these different people involved in energy reflects what's going on out there. And so we wanted to provide an index for the cap, just not make up a number out of thin air, if you will. And so we wanted to index to this. So what you see since 1981 to 2008, that's the gross operating revenue of all the entities. I'm not going to name names, obviously, but it's all the distributors and generators and suppliers and, gosh, I forgot one other factor. But anyway, all the folks in our system here in Oregon. regulated or unregulated, doesn't really matter to us. And 1%, which is what we're, which is the range we're recommending, because I didn't want to and don't know where your appetite is for the program. So 1% of the revenue for 2008 is the $73 million. I rounded to 75 when I spoke, and then 4% is the 292, which I rounded to 300 when I provided the overview. And that 1% to 4%. Would be the range that you would set the cap for a particular biennium. So if you did it at one, I'd have $75 million to pre-certify in a two-year period.
Again, and that $75 million is there, $73 million is not the amount of the project. That's the amount of the Betsy.
That's the amount of that we've obligated the taxpayer to pay for a particular project somewhere between the time that I do that and 13 years in the future.
Yeah. And just a follow-up question, Madam Chair. I mean, clearly this is one of the most sensitive and difficult things to resolve because
absolutely.
Having a dollar figure cap somewhere in statute would definitely, and that sounds like what you were describing used to happen, this method, this percentage method, seems to rely on the accuracy of these figures that are on this table,
mm-hmm.
not to be variable. I mean, and so I guess that's really what I'm just trying to get at, is these figures and a percentage of these figures are the same thing as an absolute dollar amount cap?
Potentially. Chair Burdick, Senator Rosenbaum, you could go with an absolute number. We were trying to lay out a framework, and you may want to consider multiple ways to get there. If you thought that it was a good idea to have a program cap for the renewables to provide that level of stability, you may say that that's a bad idea. We don't have a better recommendation right now. And as opposed to just kind of picking a number and not exactly sure where you start, we thought we would index that to something. And you do get some cyclical nature within the energy community because it can go up and it can go down depending upon market conditions. But we thought the thinking behind our recommendation was that we think we ought to tie something to the activity as opposed to some other factor. We looked at business receipts. We looked at percentage of other receipts collected by the state, and we thought we ought to tie to the activity. So you could do one of two approaches. You could pick a hard and fast number, or if you indexed at 1%, based on 2008, that would be $73 million. 2009, it could be lower, it could be higher, but it would be a relation. It would hopefully have some relationship to the activity out there, which may have some relationship, kind of tying the program together to what we see out in the marketplace. That's the thinking behind that. So it's kind of a yes and no to your question, I think.
Mark, to your knowledge, is there any state out there that spends more than $73 million a biennium on their subsidy program?
I believe so, Madam Chair, and then if your next question is to tell you who, I can't do that, but I certainly can find out.
We would like that information because one of the things, and it's really hard to get with the apples and oranges thing, but we have to have some way of figuring out where we are in the competitive mix. And so what I've tried to do in the past and have encouraged others to do is to try to take the subsidy program itself and just say, you know, how much, you know, either through the state expenditure, tax expenditure reports or whatever, and say, how much does Oregon spend subsidizing these things versus how much other states spend? Because that's a figure that it may not be completely accurate because there may be other factors,
yeah,
like lower property taxes or absence of
other incentives programs.
Other incentive programs, et cetera. But mm-hmm. But it still, I think, is useful to know. The ones I've looked at that I recall that had caps were in the range of $1 million. You know, a year, $1 million a biennium. I mean, they were sharply lower than this.
Right. Our recommendation to you is to not go any lower than the 1% number and feel we can get our job done in this biennium at the 4% number. And obviously, being a strong advocate for the program on the accountability side, and we understand all the other factors you have to consider in the larger role that you have, that we provided that range. I'll be happy to follow up. I know there are other states that establish caps for their programs. Again, that data is very difficult to compare, but we will do our best.
Okay. Senator Telfer. Thank you, Madam Chair. Would this cap be a biennium cap based on an annual revenue? So it's really 0.5% annually.
Chair Burdick, Senator Telfer. I'm sorry, I'm getting tongue-tied.
Telfer.
Sorry. My apologies. It would be a biennial rate that you would establish on the previous number. So okay. We would take 2008. You got, okay, 2008, and we would say for the 09-11 biennium, if you did 3%, you would roughly know what that cap is, okay. Or 4%. And then when we got to the next biennium, we would say it's going to be 3 or 4. We would know the previous year's annual rate, and it would have changed, and we would tie to that. That it would change.
Okay. All right.
Thank
Four questions. Senator Morse.
Thank you. Mark, how difficult would it be to break down these numbers in the percent that's regulated and non-regulated? Is that readily assumed from your database that you would?
I'll just give you this. I will, Chair Burdick, Senator Morse, I'll do my best. I don't know that I have that data readily available, but I will certainly, you need to know that as we developed our report and are looking at the issues, we've assembled a team of staff that have expert in a variety of areas, whether it's accountability and tax law or familiarity with utility or independent power production or program administration. I'll just get them, or data, and I'll get them together and see what we can come up with. I don't believe we have that, but I won't know till I ask.
thank you. And the other would be percent renewable and non-renewable dollars.
Okay. Well, we
if you have that, I think it would be.
Chair Burdick, Senator Moore, we clearly know renewables versus conservation versus manufacturing. I can get to that, and I think that we have jointly provided that data as part of our update. Is that right, Chris?
I believe you're, Senator Morse, you're talking about the gross operating revenue?
Gross.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Gross operating revenue.
Oh, you know, that would probably be pretty difficult, but I will ask the question.
Okay, well, if I might, to be transparent to where I'm going with this, we have a requirement for a certain percentage of our power, this gross revenue, to be delivered through renewables by a certain date certain.
And
what I want to test and push on is that's in statute. So the requirement is there. What we've chosen to do as a matter of policy is to accelerate that and do it with general fund dollars. If we challenged that assumption and said, no, we have this requirement, and the industry will progressively and rationally, through a regulated environment, will deliver that product over that time period, why are we spending potentially $250 million for what we're requiring by statute to be done? I mean, I want to test that, and I think that's a fundamental question for us. In this environment, when we have a revenue stream that is not meeting the needs of basic core services, at a time we're just assuming that we have to continue to accelerate this through general fund dollars, and I think we've got to challenge that assumption.
Chair Burdick and Senator Morse, what I think I can get for you is you may be aware that. Entities who wish to register, I think is the proper word, their generating facilities that would qualify for renewable power to meet RPS either within Oregon or somewhere within the Western grid, because it's a Western tracking system amongst the 14 states, I believe, and a couple countries. We probably could look at who has already registered RECs, as they're called, and compare to see if we funded any of those. Now, that's not going to be comprehensive, but that's probably what I can get you, that level of data, and we can make some comparisons. I don't know what they're going to, you know, we don't know until somebody registers what they're intending and where they intend to use that REC and for which regulatory qualification. But I'll run some numbers and ask staff and get back to you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Thanks for bringing that up. Other questions? Okay. Continue.
Okay. So that's the program cap and then the prioritization component. The other piece that we recommended is establishing what we're calling an alternative funding model for mature renewable projects. And the thinking behind this is right now we have a system that on renewable projects essentially pays 50% of the project cost, and there's a maximum cap that you're familiar with. We're suggesting that as a particular market, in this case wind, is moving towards the ability to stand alone, that there be an alternative funding model. And I want to be clear that we're recommending a framework, so this I hope would apply to other markets as they mature. I mean, the goal of all this is to incent the behavior, test the market area, get things going, and at some point move to it either, like I said, what we're recommending, an alternative model, or off the system altogether. And so what we've recommended, and I think this is the first time this approach has been at least discussed within the core group I put together, is an alternative model. So you'd still have your standard model that we have now, our 50% at our maximum rate. But we would have this alternative model that would move to 5% of the project cost as opposed to 50% of the cost. Now, there's several reasons for doing that. In addition to the alternative model, we're recommending that 5% decline per year till you get to zero. So the theory being, you've got a market, we've provided the incentives, it's done what we want it to do, we move it to the alternative model, and eventually that level of support declines to the point that there isn't any, and that market is off on its own, and then markets come in, and we hope that other things will be successful regardless of what we're talking about, and you kind of move it through, and that's how you kind of manage the natural growth and the natural changes that change within these markets. We obviously have to pick rates, and you have to caps in order to figure eligible costs. In our report, and we've left it open in this summary because, again, we believe the beauty of the framework is you can kind of plug in. You can plug in a renewable cap mount, and you can plug in when you place that timing. So you can, if you like the idea, you can plug that in, and you can index it, or you can put a hard number, if you will. You can, if you like the idea of an alternative model, you can plug that in, and if you can plug in, it's easy to plug in the concept that it's moving to 5% of the project cost, and it declines over a year, and then you just set a maximum eligibility, and then that sets the net rate. And so what we recommended in our report, working within the current framework, is 5% of the project cost for wind at a $200 million maximum project rate, which is essentially the $10 million that you have currently. Those things can be changed. And, again, we think that moving to that model helps with that dynamic that I discussed of taking a market, putting it in a different place, and kind of moving it along. Secondly, from the state's perspective, 5% of $200 million project is a higher return on investment than 50% of a $20 million project, and that those are the same numbers net to the that we're spending. So we think it has several advantages. Within that, We obviously recognize that there's a difference between, if you will, utility or community scale, and we looked at the 55 or 56 projects in wind that we've received application on since 2001, and we are recommending, and again, this number is completely able to be plugged in at a different amount. We're suggesting that if your project is around $100,000 wind, that remain at the 50% level. So if you were over 100,000, you would go to a project cost 5% and you would decline. So I don't know if I've accurately captured that thought. That's in our report. That's something new that I'm not sure if we've discussed in committee before. And we think that, again, there's a couple things. It looks at the return on investment to the state. It moves maturing markets and markets that their ability to stand alone into a different place. And frankly, as if you start at your 5% and you move to 4, 3, 2, and you start seeing behavioral changes within the market, projects and those kinds of things, you may want to come back in and say, hey, wait a minute, we're comfortable with 2 or 3. We think that's the right number based on what we're seeing. And it allows us to kind of, in a manner that everybody's familiar with, kind of test where you get that sweet spot on the support level. So we recommend that approach. Again, there are several different decision points that if you set the cap at 200, that's 10, maximum 10 you would fund for a $200 million project. You could adjust that. But we are recommending the alternative model, and then that declining percentage point way is a really way to look at these kinds of issues that I know that you've grappled with as far as what's the right level of funding.
Just to flag something on this area, this is going to be one of the areas where there's going to be a lot of discussion on large versus small.
Mm-hmm.
Just to give some perspective, before 2007, there was a $3.5 million maximum credit because it was 35% with a cap of $10 million.
Mm-hmm.
We basically doubled that in 2009. But I just saw some numbers from legislative revenue yesterday that showed even under the old system, the program was booming in a way that we are just beginning to understand. Under the old system, there were a lot of...
Under the old 35% rate.
$3.5 million maximum.
Okay.
And House Bill 2472 set a maximum for a project of $3.5 million, regardless of the size. Now, the strength of your proposal is it takes away the artificial incentive to limit your projects to $20 million. So it doesn't give you any advantage for... basically slicing and dicing or trying to, do a number of different projects, which creates some efficiencies. The disadvantage of it is, I was, after the extensive research we did on 2472, this committee and this Senate was very comfortable with a $3.5 million total cap, for the larger projects.
Mm-hmm.
And this committee and this Senate was very sensitive to the needs of the smaller, more innovative, more cutting-edge projects that were out there. So I just wanted to flag this as an area that's probably going to need more work, but to also praise the overall structure, which, takes away an artificial incentive that never should have been there. But that this one in particular, to continue in this revenue climate, to continue allowing a project to have $10 million is not in the spirit of what this committee did and what the Senate did in 2472. But the framework itself, I think, is a much better way to go than what we had before.
There's a whole set of benefits we believe by moving to this model, and you touched on some others. And the other piece, and I know that you're aware of this, the department has been concerned that there may be projects who need that funding at the base rate to kind of get them going. And I know that we're very interested in our other markets and continuing to push those forward. So we think this has the ability to kind of deal with this you know, kind of long-term and move things along, and we kind of just see this kind of evolution of projects moving over to this and de-escalating down. We understand there's some tensions built in between the community and the utility scale. We've talked about those. It's the model, again, the framework allows us to kind of plug that in. And within the report, we gave you some scenarios of how that might change the state's investment if we would have had this model, or if we go to this model over time, and what that would be on a per project basis. So would you like me to continue on?
Please do, unless there's other questions. Go ahead.
Great. So item number four, I don't know how much we've talked about this, but we're recommending that you, for the Betsy tax credit program, you eliminate the ability to amend prior tax returns. And this is an issue really when you get into a pass-through or third-party situation where obviously normal tax laws, you can go back and amend previous returns. You can create a situation of it's difficult to predict future impacts, program impacts, because of the variable nature already between 1 and 13 years. And then if you have a three-year look back, that makes it even more challenging for all of us to kind of tell you where we stand on a particular program or a particular project. Secondly, you create a situation where, it's designed to have that impact occur over at least a five-year period, if not longer. And in some situations, you're seeing the impact occur the first year, three-fifths.
Well, I think it's clearly within the spirit. Let's not spend a lot of time on this, because I don't see any argument for
I didn't know how familiar the committee was with this issue. Number five is we recommend, because of the timing and the complexity around manufacturing, believe the manufacturing side of the Betsy is distinct and different than renewable and conservation, that you extend the manufacturing tax credit sunset date that's currently at 012. Several of the manufacturing facilities that we've been able to track to Oregon, those are five-year negotiations or five-year discussions, if you will, and we don't believe that we're able to provide the predictability. And, talking with Director of Business Oregon, Tim McCabe, I mean, we have a window of time to attract these businesses to Oregon, believe that they have positive impact overall, and we need to have that level of certainty. So we've recommended that. We also recommend, and we understand it is a discussion point, we've recommended the conservation program for some of the same kinds of things, although a little bit different. Again, our focus and recommendations to you were around the renewables, which are the large driver, have the complex issues, and we would like to kind of focus on the areas where we see the rapid growth and the complex issues. So the last piece is, we just tried to capture for you what, if you like the framework as an overall, we understand the devil's in the details, and that depending on where you set a program cap amount has a certain level of policy and revenue implications, but we've tried to identify kind of the decision points, the cap amount, the date, the funding model, what the maximum credit amount is for large projects versus small, that's getting at the community versus utility, and then the accountability measures, where I indicated that we broke those up into three kind of categories, things that would apply to all projects, just kind of good government things, which would be, I believe, I think four and five. Yes, I think that's right. No, six and seven, excuse me. One through three would be prospective. Four and five would go into effect whenever you hopefully pass a bill one through three would be looking at all. Four and five would go into effect at particular timing, and six and seven would be prospective, if I got that right. So that's our framework. Obviously, there's a great deal more detail within the 50-plus pages that are in the report, but I wanted to kind of provide where we were at and give the committee an update. We have sat down with legislative council and have begun laying out the framework, but not plugging in the decision points, because we understand that you, as well as the House, need to provide that direction. So
right, and this doesn't really get to the issue of retroactivity, committee, but as you'll recall in House Bill 2472, we had a retroactive date of June 1st for the basic structural changes, and this is for pre-certifications that were issued after June 1st. And it would certainly be my intent to follow that retroactivity framework in any new legislation we propose, because there's been a flood of applications since the veto came out, and certainly after June 1st. And yet business, people who are making business investment decisions have been on notice since the bill was passed, even though it was vetoed. It remains under the Oregon Constitution on the table, subject to an override. So anybody making an investment decision after June 1st should know that they were at risk. And in order to get the kind of corrections we need in this program, we're going to have to go back to that retroactivity date. And we are on firm legal ground. I asked for an opinion from Legislative Council. If you have opinion, if you have questions on it, Kate Toswell's prepared to address it. But we are on very strong legal ground to make any changes that we make in this program retroactive. There's case law on tax law, which I'm sure you're very aware of. But even more importantly, the community we're trying to encourage and work with here has been on notice very clearly in House Bill 2472 that June 1st was an important deadline for them. So.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, I don't know how much was discussed before. Unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, I think it's fortunate on what we're doing, but rules that we adopted and the administrative actions that we're taking within the agency impact the base that Chris provides you an update on. And we will be, and are, as you know, spending time working with staff to kind of identify all that stuff, because that's going to equal a number out there. And then we're going to provide to you at some point, probably around the first of the year or first of the month, if shortly thereafter, framework and other things, so you can kind of make those different policy decisions. That's why we left those implementation dates open, because I think you'll have a series of, okay, well, if you do this, here's what happens. And I know you're aware of this. This is kind of for everybody. And if you do this, here's what happens. And we need to rebuild the base estimate of kind of where we're at with the program and all the measures we've took in place. And that's something that we're still working on, Chris. Is that correct? And I know you're still getting data from us, and we owe you some provisions, because that impacts all of this. So what I hope to do today is to share the framework. Excuse me. And obviously, there are decision points, and then the next discussion is, okay, if you do this, what's the impact, and programmatically as well as revenue-wise.
And I
don't have those answers for you.
I really appreciate your coming today, and want to again commend you on producing this comprehensive report on such short notice. It's been a breath of fresh air running through that department to have. I really feel like you're making real progress at getting a grasp of some of these issues, and it was a great piece of work. This committee has, was very active in trying to kind of get a handle on the program during the last session. It's why I wanted you to come and give us a full briefing today. But the committee, I'm sure, understands that this bill will originate in the House, and we expect good work from the House as we had before on 2472. I think we probably got more of the attention, but the work that went on in the House on House Bill 2472 was very positive in making those structural changes that are reflected in your recommendation, reflected and expanded on very positively.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, I mean, there have been times when I've been pretty down in the dumps about this program, but I'm optimistic that we're headed on the right track, and again, want to commend you and your staff for all your very, very hard work. And I know that there are a lot of new people there who have had to get up to speed and lightning speed. I see a couple of them in the audience here smiling. They can still smile. That's a good sign. So I think we're headed on the right track, and I think the governor's office participation in this as well has been very positive.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you for mentioning the staff. Obviously, going through where we're at, both on the need to address the program, but the outside attention that we received, and I think the staff has done a great job of kind of rallying around and hopefully providing you the level of information you need and a framework for you to consider. So it's really, this is a result of many, many hours of lots of people back at the agency kind of rallying around the cause. So thank you for mentioning that, and I just wanted to get that on the record. There's a bunch of folks that deserve credit for this work.
Good. Well, thank you, and thank you for drawing them to you. Are there other questions or comments from the committee?
I have a question, I think, for you and the staff, not for Mark, but you mentioned the bill is starting on the House, and so do you have any idea at this point what kind of committee time would be allocated in this committee to hearing this once it
this
gets
will,
through the House?
This bill will get all the time it takes. Everyone is on notice.
Uh-huh.
Make your reservations early. No, this is probably the most important thing this committee will do during the supplemental session. And we will schedule accordingly. Other questions, comments? Thank you very much. Really appreciate you and your staff's efforts on this. We finished a little early, so we get a 10-minute break.
Great.
Please come back on time because we've got other exciting things. We are in recess for 10 minutes. We will reconvene the Senate Interim Committee on Finance and Revenue, and our next agenda item will be on property tax exemptions for low-income housing day.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, this topic is related, well, actually it's part of concepts in LC 61 that Paul introduced and you guys adopted. And it relates to property tax exemption for parts of multiple unit low-income housing that are being used for other than housing or residential purposes. So we have Chair Wheeler and also from City of Portland. And then the final issue that will be discussed is this is already in the statute, but it's property tax exemption for newly constructed residential housing occupied by low-income persons or property held for future development as low-rental housing, and mostly in Lane County. And representative from City of Eugene will have testimonies.
Okay, well, let's begin with Chair Wheeler from Multnomah County. And I want to direct the committee's attention to the testimony we have in front of us from Commissioner Fish. We had a phone conversation. Are you up here for him? Would you want to come up? And we had a phone conversation, and I gave him dispensation from appearing personally, but he has done a wonderful job of working with Chair Wheeler on this. So, Chair Wheeler, take it away.
Thank you very much, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ted Wheeler, Chairman of the Board of County Commissioners of Multnomah County. As Chair Burdick just mentioned, I'm here on behalf of myself as well as Portland City Commissioner Nick Fish. I'd like to thank all of you for the opportunity to speak to you about an issue that's very important both to the City of Portland as well as Multnomah County, namely the use of property tax abatements to incent housing creation in mixed-use developments in critical need areas. I'm here today to let you know that I support the grandfathering of existing mixed-use developments in my county that are currently participating in a housing incentive property tax abatement program. As you know, the Attorney General issued a report last spring that stated only the housing portion of these mixed-use developments are actually eligible for the property tax abatement. These existing mixed-use projects that we'd like to grandfather entered into agreements with the City of Portland with the understanding that the entire project would receive the abatement as long as the appropriate affordable housing component was incorporated into the overall projects. I want to honor those agreements. It's my belief that it's the fair thing to do as well as the right thing to do. Portland City Commissioner Fish and I are conducting a long overdue policy review to solve some of the issues that have come up around the implementation and administration of these kinds of tax exemption programs. As identified in two separate audit reports, one from the City of Portland Auditor and one from the Multnomah County Commission Auditor, better oversight is needed to ensure that the public goals are met and that there's a strong accountability component in place so that these abatements are not tax giveaways at the expense of critical public services. In order to move forward with the policy review that Commissioner Fish and I are proposing, we need to be fair to those mixed-use development projects that did follow the rules. This is why I'm here today to support this legislation to grandfather these existing projects. I want to be clear that Portland and Multnomah County have a lot of work to do in terms of improving these programs. We're not yet prepared to tackle anything beyond grandfathering these existing projects in terms of legislation for the February session. I want to thank Senator Burdick for getting this legislation introduced on our behalf, and I also want to publicly thank Commissioner Fish and the City of Portland for being very good partners in this undertaking. I'm more than happy to answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for working so constructively with the city folks to develop a really good, narrow solution to this. Are there questions for Chair Wheeler before we move on? Thank you. And you've been joined by Doug Oblitz from Portland, so we'll get to you in a minute. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Good morning, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you this morning. My name, for the record, is Kate Allen. I am the Housing Policy Manager for the City of Portland's Housing Bureau. Appreciate the opportunity to discuss the limited tax exemption bill before you proposed. Unfortunately, Commissioner Fish, the city's housing commissioner, was unable to be here today. However, I would like to convey his appreciation to Senator Burdick for introducing the legislation on our behalf and to the committee for taking the time to hear the bill today. Following upon Chair Wheeler's brief overview of the proposed legislation, I'd like to just a minute to give you some policy context. As you might know, these programs have been strategically used since the 70s. They were developed at the request of the City of Portland and others in response to a trend in the 50s and 60s where downtown Portland lost nearly 50% of its housing stock. At the time, the city needed statutes that authorized programs that would promote new housing construction in Portland's core through the use of property tax exemptions. The authorization included housing projects that had commercial components, and the idea was to keep the land taxed to encourage new construction that remained untaxed for 10 years, to return the new value of the land and improvements at the end of 10 years, and to achieve public policy goals which benefit the citizens. Following the legislature's action in that timeline, Portland instituted the new multi-unit housing program to promote high-density residential and mixed-use development in the central city plan area and urban renewal areas in the core. Under the program, property owners received a 10-year tax exemption on both the housing and the commercial components of the development. Now, since those early days, cities have grown and evolved, and where people live and how they commute has changed, and the need for more affordable housing has skyrocketed. Therefore, more programs were authorized, including programs which encourage development of multi-unit housing near transit corridors. Since then, the city adopted the Transit-Oriented Development, or the TOD, program in 1996, and 16 projects have been approved for the TOD tax exemption, resulting in about 1,100 units that are well located. The programs have allowed the city to meet desired transportation, growth management, and housing targets. Regional investment in the MAX light rail line and other public transit facilities is supported by new high-density housing developments that have been built close to the rail stations and other transit facilities with the assistance of these programs. Construction of new housing assisted by these programs has assisted programs in other areas such as the Gateway Regional Center and the Hollywood Town Center, reducing the need to expand the region's urban growth boundary to accommodate new residents and reducing pressure on farm and forest land. Lastly, low, moderate, and middle-income households have benefited from the additional housing opportunities assisted by these programs. For-profit developers have used the program to assist in the development of low-income housing, and nonprofit developers have used the program to develop mixed-income housing that contains some market-rate units. As Chair Wheeler said, what brings us here before you today is the result of an opinion delivered by the Attorney General's Office in August of 2009, which called into question the statutory authority for granting abatements on the commercial portion of the bill, or commercial portion of the project. And as a result of the opinion, 19 property owners received tax bills from Multnomah County for the first time on their exempted properties. The county assessed taxes on the commercial space, even though in each case the city had granted exemptions that included the commercial improvements. Currently, many of the property owners are contesting the tax bills, and the process is slow and costly. In each case, the property owners relied on the exemption when they proceeded to obtain financing, set rents, and make other business decisions regarding the properties. And for most of these developments, both the exemption itself and the inclusion of rent-generating commercial space assisted the developer to obtain project financing by improving the financial viability of the project. Furthermore, the inclusion of commercial space provided a public benefit by encouraging businesses to locate in then underserved areas. Many developers have reported that the assessments in some cases have jeopardized the financial viability of multifamily projects And a good example is of the kind of project we're talking about is the Museum Place, a multifamily development, which Doug Oblitz was one of the developers of. This is a property in downtown Portland where the ground floor Safeway store serves neighborhood residents throughout the west end of downtown and includes tenants who live in affordable units in that property above the store. Doug will share the developer perspective in just a moment. Once this issue came to the attention of Commissioner Fish, we have worked closely with Chair Wheeler and the staff at the county and the affected developers and other interested parties to reach agreement on a solution. And the proposed legislation before you is a simple technical fix to this unforeseen problem, narrow in its approach, and it will only grandfather the affected properties, a total of 19 in Portland and one in Gresham. As the funds, revenue funds, were not anticipated and furthermore would have gone to the urban renewal districts in which the properties are located, the revenue impact of the proposed legislation is limited. Finally, all affected parties are on board and supportive of this proposed legislation. Putting aside the city's success in the programs drawing multipurpose developments to underserved areas, the city feels that the issue before you today is a matter of fairness to our private sector partners that played by the rules to do public good by developing much-needed mixed-use housing developments with commercial components. We also, and on behalf of Commissioner Fish, take very seriously a broad look at the programs and their effectiveness in partnership with the county. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today, and also am happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Maybe we'll take Mr. Oblitz and then open it up for questions.
Good morning, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning. For the record, I'm Douglas Oblitz. I'm the manager of Sockeye Development, LLC, in Portland. Sockeye Development and our affiliated project management services company, Shields Oblitz Johnson, Inc., are recognized for our involvement in complex public infrastructure projects and innovative public-private partnerships. Sockeye is the developer and owner of three of Portland's most award-winning and innovative urban mixed-use projects, the Belmont Dairy in Southeast Portland, the Hollywood Library and Bookmark Apartments in the Hollywood District, and Museum Place in downtown Portland. The latter two projects, Museum Place and the Bookmark Apartments in Northeast, are impacted by the draft legislation before you today. And Museum Place is kind of the poster child for the issue, as it is the project suffering the greatest financial impact from the county's decision to take away our property tax exemption. The types of projects that Sockeye has developed and the other projects that are on the list that have lost their exemption are extremely difficult to develop. Building quality, high-density urban mixed-use projects is very, very challenging. Compared to typical wood-frame suburban apartments, this urban product is more expensive to build, land is more expensive, and the cost to provide structured parking is off the charts. If we were to build the underground parking at Museum Place today, it would cost in excess of $50,000 a space to provide. To give you some sense of the complexity of the Museum Place deal, let me give you just a few highlights. It was a $42 million project in 2001. The land was publicly acquired by PDC, who performed the environmental remediation and demolition. They then sold us the land at a write-down, with a land write-down. And the city of Portland issued $30 million in taxable and tax-exempt bonds, which were credit-enhanced by Fannie Mae in a manner that had never been done before. It took a lot of exemptions from Fannie Mae to get this project done. The city also provided $3 million in low-interest loans. We had a capital contribution from Safeway and a 10-year property tax exemption for the entire structure. That is a very complicated transaction. And the project financing was highly dependent on the property tax exemption. Without it, we would not have been able to borrow enough money for the project to be feasible. To be clear on that point, by virtue of the property tax exemption, the promise of the property tax exemption, we were able to demonstrate enough net operating income to justify a loan large enough to pay the cost of the project, including those extraordinary costs for the parking. Without the exemption, the project would have had a significant financing gap and probably would not have been built. And it's not as though we got a free ride from the exemption. All of our mixed-use projects include a component of affordable housing, targeted to households earning between 50 and 60% of area median income. And we have a requirement to maintain this affordable housing for 60 years under City of Portland requirements. Another key issue is the treatment of the property tax exemption relative to the entire structure. Museum Place was built and financed as a single structure and a single financing package. There is a very tight relationship between the residential and commercial components, both from a use and financing standpoint. And this is the type of building, the type of development the city wanted to see in order to set the tone for development in downtown and in the West End neighborhood. Our building is highly responsive to these public objectives, and a single-story building, for Safeway, for instance, which could have been built on the site, or a single-use residential building would not have met these public objectives. As such, there are a number of other community benefits that result from our development of Museum Place. We were able to rebuild what was at the time the only full-service grocery store in downtown and replace what was known as Psycho Safeway. And Safeway is everybody's store, from the street people to people living in SROs to middle-income people and residents of the West Hills. It's the most democratic grocery store in the state of Oregon, I would argue. And it is an important focal point within downtown. The project is built of brick and concrete. It's built with lasting materials, and it has set the tone for other development of long-lasting projects in the neighborhood. And mixing housing and a grocery store is also very green. Knowing that the store is just downstairs is a major selling point for our apartments, but in fact, people drive less and have fewer cars as a result of living there. And for those that can't afford a lot of rent, much less a car, it's an important lifeline for their existence in downtown Portland. The availability of the property tax exemption was also a considerable inducement for Safeway to participate in the project. Recognizing that the typical Safeway store is 60,000 square feet and is built within a massive surface parking lot, we had to convince Safeway to build their typical store on a 40,000 square foot downtown block and have their parking hidden below in an underground structure. They also needed to incur additional rent associated with a much more expensive store, not only one that has underground parking, but also has a two-level store with four elevators. And I can tell you that I had a lot more hair before I negotiated the lease with Safeway. It was a difficult deal.
Not true.
But seriously, the property tax exemption made a huge difference to Safeway in terms of wanting to be involved in a project and depart from their normal store standards. One other interesting point, in the end, the presence of the commercial space does have a direct bearing on the success of the housing. We've actually looked carefully at this and have determined that the presence of the commercial space within the structure and within the total financing of the project actually helps reduce the rents necessary to service the residential debt on the project. In other words, without the income from the Safeway store, our break-even residential rents would actually have to be higher. In developing these projects and assembling the complex financing structures that support them, we reasonably relied on the City of Portland and Multnomah County's representation of the availability of the property tax exemption. As I mentioned, Museum Place was one of the most complicated real estate transactions ever undertaken in Portland. It took a long time, and it took a lot of perseverance to get it done. We played by the rules, secured all the necessary approvals required for the exemption, and depended upon the availability of the exemption in representing the project to our lenders. We've operated the project for 6 years on the basis of the exemption. The county's decision to take away the exemption and the Attorney General's interpretation in support of the county's action is changing the rules mid-game, and we feel that's unfair. We also believe it creates a financial hardship and the potential to unwind our complex financing. While the extra $160,000 a year is a small amount to Multnomah County, it's a huge amount to us, particularly in these very challenging real estate times. Today, these additional taxes represent about half of the net cash flow of the project, and even in better times, the impact would be significant. Thank you again for the opportunity to appear before you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for any member of the panel? Thank you very much. Committee, this with our abbreviated schedule in February, this may be actually our hearing on this. So I really appreciate you coming down during this relatively calm period and educating us about this. Senator Morris.
Just one question, a confirmation question, Ms. Allen. do these tax exemptions translate into lower rents? And I assume that they do, but would you address that issue?
Yes. Two specific programs that we're talking about, the new multi-unit affordable housing program and the transit-oriented development program. Both of those include, as one of the public benefits provided, the provision of affordable housing. So we're able to say their projects are mixed income. Some of them are predominantly affordable. Some of them are predominantly market, but there are affordable components, affordable units with the long-term guarantee of the affordability in all of the properties affected.
Thank you for confirming that.
And then this, just for clarity, this bill would only grandfather in projects that have already been approved on this basis. So the conversation about how to manage this exemption going forward is continuing between the county and the city. So we'll be waiting for other recommendations that come out of that discussion, potentially. But this one just deals with ones that have made that investment decision in the past.
Correct. So,
thank you. And again, thanks for the spirit of cooperation between the city and the county on this. Everyone is very hard, very strapped for funds. And so it was a good cooperation.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you
for having us.
Thank you. Okay, we got somebody from the City of Eugene. Mr. Lanningham. Not used to seeing you in this committee.
I'll be seeing you later today.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Van Landingham. I work as a lawyer for Lane County Legal Aid and Advocacy Center. I'm also here on behalf of the Housing Alliance and the City of Eugene, where I've advocated for affordable housing for about 30 years. We're here about a different property tax exemption statute, and we're hopeful that you will include our issue, small though it is, important to us, in your LC 61. This has to do with ORS 307.515 to 537. Right, 3537. It's a state-authorized local option property tax exemption for low-income rental housing. So state-authorized, you authorize it in statute. Local governments have to adopt it. It's limited to low-income rental housing. Program was adopted. The statute was adopted in 89. It had a sunset of December 31, 2009. We missed it. I would say I missed it, and I should have raised it in the 2009 legislative session and didn't. We hope that you can, in the special session, extend that sunset or renew it, I guess. It's limited, as I said, to low-income rental housing serving Oregonians with incomes at 60% of median or less. It can be new construction if the rents reflect the reduced property taxes. It can be acquisition of existing housing by a nonprofit. It has to be adopted by local jurisdictions. If those local jurisdictions that adopt it represent more than 51% of the tax base, then 100% of the property taxes are waived for that property. In most cities, that means both the city and the school district. The exemption is good for 20 years. At the end of the 20-year period, the property comes back onto the property tax rolls. Some properties would not be built but for this property tax exemption. It's typically administered by a city. Since 1989, several dozen cities have used the exemption, including Albany, Coos Bay, Medford, and Springfield. There is no master list that the state keeps, so I think probably I'm the person that best tracks who has it and who doesn't. Currently, I believe only Eugene and Bend are using it or wish to use it. I've been told that Bend wishes to use it for what's known as a preservation project, an existing subsidized project which could convert to private market rents, and discussions with the city to acquire it by Northwest Housing Alternatives. Richie Weinman of the City of Eugene is going to talk about how Eugene operates the program, and Terry McDonald of St. Vincent de Paul is going to talk about why it's important. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So I'm Richie Weinman. I'm Community Services Manager for the City of Eugene, and I've worked on low-income housing for, about 27 years with the City of Eugene, so not as many as him, but close. The City of Eugene has a long history of supporting low-income housing and affordable housing. We recognize how important it is for the community. If you ask somebody who works for a social service agency what their problems are, they'll always tell you that you have to have people housed before you can work on their other issues, no matter what their other issues are. And we have found that to be very true in our community and our city council, which you might be surprised to know they don't always agree on everything in the city of Eugene. They have unanimous agreement about low-income housing issues, and we have brought 20 tax exemption proposals to them over the years, and they've unanimously approved every one of them. And that's because they've all worked out really well. I could drive you by any of those projects today without anybody knowing that we're coming, and you'd be pleased to see what they look like. They look great. Some of them are St. Vincent de Paul's. He's sitting next to me here. They reduce the rents by about $100 a month, and that's a huge amount of money for a low-income household. That's the difference between whether you can buy prescription medications or food or shoes for your kids or whatever it is each month. That's a huge amount of money, and we want to do whatever we can to make housing affordable. We have a big problem in our community. We have enough homeless people during the course of a year that we can't sit them all in Mack Court at the University of Oregon campus.
Okay.
We have enough homeless youth that they can't all fit in one of our high schools. So we have a big problem, and that's just the homeless. The low-income population is much greater. So 20 years ago, I was here in this building advocating for this very exemption program, and it crept up on us, and we've been using it over the years, and it's worked pretty well. And suddenly it's gone, and we have a project in the pipeline right now that needs it and a couple of others that are counting on it. Terry will talk about the one that needs it right now. I provide a letter for you from School District 4J, from Lane County, and from the Housing Policy Board, which is an intergovernmental advisory committee that advises on low-income housing projects. They typically look at these exemptions before they go to City Council. They examine them closely. The Housing Policy Board includes two former school board members from Eugene, elected officials from Eugene, Springfield, and Lane County. And so we have a pretty good process where we feel comfortable that when we advocate, when we allow an exemption, when we take one to City Council for approval, that we know it's going to be a good project and we haven't had any problems with any of them. So I'm going to leave it at that if you have any questions for me. I just really hope that you'll consider extending this legislation for us. It's really important.
Just very briefly, the Lane County supports this?
They do, and there's a letter. Like this.
I just found it.
So Lane County supports it. The school district supports it. City of Eugene supports it.
In other words, the people who have to pay for it support it.
Exactly right.
Okay. All
and
right.
They recognize the value of how important this is to the community, that the cost benefit of low-income housing far outweighs the small amount of money that we would be giving up in taxes.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Sure.
Welcome.
Senator Burdick, members of the committee, thank you for letting me speak today. I'm Terry McDonald. I'm the director of St. Vincent de Paul Society of Lane County. And, of course, I would hope that you would see a way to cede to moving this forward into the years forward. St. Vincent de Paul has developed about 950 units of affordable housing over the last 20 years, most of it in Lane County. As Richie has pointed out, having safe, affordable, and decent housing for people that are at low income, and typically we build for households that are at between 43% and 50% of median income, is a critical feature of how you're going to hold the social network of a community together. We deal with families that have AIDS. We deal with victims of domestic violence, ex-offenders, and most recently we're doing a lot of housing for veterans. Many of them dual-diagnosed veterans coming off of long times on the street. So for us, the ability to land that housing, of course, is always a task and it's always difficult. Currently, we're under the development of a 35-unit apartment complex in West Eugene called the Lamb Building. We did apply for and from the city, and we're granted that exemption, not realizing that it was sunsetting right now, and are in the midst of the construction of that project right now. The typical amount of write-down in terms of rent that people will have to pay on that project is approximately $100 per unit per month. So it's the difference between a family having an affordable rent and one that is significantly less affordable for us. This particular legislation's extension is critical for this project to go forward, but more importantly, philosophically, understanding that the community has really invested in this idea of taking from themselves, as Richie has pointed out, and allowing our low-income citizens to have a safe, decent, affordable housing available to them at a price that they can afford to live in is really a crucial feature of the whole template of services that St. Vincent de Paul and other housing providers are trying to provide in our communities. I urge you to support this.
If I could provide a quick clarification. Okay. He applied for the tax exemption. It got a recommendation from the committee. It hasn't been approved by the city council because they can't.
Right. It's kind of illegal. Yeah. Okay. I appreciate you bringing this to our attention. You know, that's the problem with some of these sunsets. You really got to keep track of them, and it's easy to let them fall through. And it's also kind of a, I don't know what we'll do on this particular amendment, but it's certainly a plug for having supplemental sessions where you don't have to wait for a whole year for an outcome on this.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much for bringing this to our attention. Okay. Our next item is New Market Tax Credits. Who's doing that? Are you doing that? Where did Chris go? Uh-oh.
I'm going to run.
Chris is AWOL.
Well, we're 2 minutes early.
He should know this is a lean, mean committee. We don't waste time.
No, you can't stay away from Betsy.
Come on, you just fake it.
How do I go online and get the train back? Or something like that.
Well, there's software you get from YouTube videos that will let you.
Okay, our next. Should we go in recess or an ask? Our next item is the New Market Tax Credits. And we took this up as a committee this last session, and it will be a House bill this year, but I just wanted to have an update for the committee so that we can be up to speed when this comes forward again in the supplemental session. So, Paul, do you have anything to add?
Madam Chair, just kind of procedurally, as you recall, the committee passed a version of this with a due pass recommendation last session. It was referred to Ways and Means, where it ended the session. And so the chair met with the folks that had been working on it, and they made some modifications to that Senate bill, and it is in the process of being introduced as a committee bill and House Revenue Committee. So that's kind of where it is in the process right now. But the intent today is to update the committee on the proposed changes and to remind you what the key elements of the measure were.
Great. Okay, and we have the Campbells, and we have Carl Talton here. Let's just everybody come up at once. Okay, why don't you start, Craig?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell, and I'm here on behalf of Advantage Capital Partners, and with me is Danielle Delgadillo from Advantage Capital Partners, and she fortunately knows a lot more about the details, so if there are any questions, she's able to handle those. What we wanted to do is quickly give you an update on what's going on with the bill. The substance of the bill itself hasn't changed too terribly much. We're still talking about a 39% matching tax credit to the federal New Markets Tax Credit, which would equate to $78 million over the span of 7 years, which would make available about $200 million in private sector investments in small business types of investments in low-income tract areas of the state where those who are applying for the funds have been refused loan funds from traditional banking sources. Now, in discussions after the last session, we've made some adjustments to the bill that came before you. They're not tremendous adjustments, but there are really more things to kind of make people more comfortable about where there would otherwise maybe be leakages around a tax credit. One of them is the desire to have a sunset date. There is a 4-year sunset date in the bill. Now, even though this particular sunset This particular tax credit would run out after the $78 million has been expended by the state. We put the tax credit in so that we try to front-load the investments. So if you haven't made the investments within the first 4 years, you're no longer eligible to enter into the game. The second issue is that it currently imposes a $5 million maximum, and that's an issue that I know that Mr. Tolton is going to talk to you about. And that's a policy issue that I'll revisit in just a moment. The tax credit that is associated with the New Markets Tax Credit will not be transferable, so you can't basically create a separate market for the tax credit. It doesn't allow the recipients of the Oregon New Markets Tax Credit to stack this tax credit with other tax credits. And we are pushing back the date of start to the beginning of next biennium so as not to create any fiscal impact during this biennium. So those are the basic changes. The one thing I want to say about the $5 million, $10 million cap requirement is that because we know February is going to require quick action, what we would prefer to do is get that issue resolved as quickly as possible so that we're not trying to amend the bill during the February session because we're afraid that any friction on any of the bills trying to get through the session will make it much more difficult to accomplish the task. So any direction that you as a committee would be willing to give to us or to the House committee who is dropping the bill would be greatly appreciated. We'll be in front of them tomorrow to talk to them about the issue.
Okay, and on the transferability, the impact of having that not be transferable is that unless the business becomes profitable, they can't use the tax credit. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, the people who have purchased the tax credits, those that would be able to take the tax credit, they can only take the tax credit if they have a profit. Now, they can roll over that tax credit into future years, so if they become profitable.
Wait a minute, but I'm misunderstanding. Does the business itself have to be profitable for them to take the tax credit, or just the investors in maybe some of their other investments have to be profitable?
Madam Chair, it's the latter. The people who are getting the tax credit, they're the ones who need to be profitable, not the businesses. Now, obviously, when those people are investing in those businesses, they're going to be investing in businesses that are going to make a return, because that's where the people who are kind of brokering the deal between the people who ultimately get the tax credit and those companies who receive the loans, they want to make sure that they're profitable because that's their investment there. But as far as the tax credit itself, it's the company that owns the tax credit, not the company that the investment is made in, that needs to be profitable in order for them to take advantage of the tax credit.
Senator Hess.
Thank you. At least on that point, though, just because we were talking about Betsy, there's not this present value, this loss, this discount that's lost by taxpayers. At least, I mean, the money, the incentive is there, and the beneficiaries receive 100% of it, as opposed to part of it going out somewhere where we didn't intend to subsidize or help.
Madam Chair, Senator Haas, that's correct. We're trying to not allow it to become part of a basically creating a market unto itself for tax credits, which isn't our goal. Our goal is to get money to businesses so that they can start investing, hiring people, and getting going. And we want that to be as potent as possible.
Other questions? Okay, thank you. We'll save you for questions if we need to, Danielle.
Sounds great.
Mr. Tolton.
Thank you, Chairman Burdick. Committee members. My name is Carl Tolton. I'm the executive chairman of the Portland Family Funds United Fund Advisor Organization. We're an Oregon-based company, grown and based here in Oregon, and we're among the most respected and experienced New Markets Tax Credit entities in the country. We've completed or advised on about 40 different projects across the country, which represent about $600 million in deployment of New Markets Tax Credits. And we do want to encourage the adoption of this legislation as it's been outlined here. We think it's very good, but with the inclusion of a $10 million cap. Our experience and the track record, I think, of the industry in general suggests that a $5 million cap would severely reduce the opportunity to participate in the program. Certainly, it would reduce our opportunity. A $10 million cap does not mean that every project will hit the maximum. We've done a number of projects on where there virtually is no cap, And we've done several projects at the $4 million level, but they typically have generated few returns, but there have been community benefits associated with them that made them very worthwhile doing. So it's not impossible to do them at that level, but it certainly cuts down the opportunity both for our participation and for a broad range of participation by other investors to come in. Very often, worthy projects that offer longer-term benefits will require an additional allocation. The Vanport project on Martin Luther King Boulevard in Portland is probably the one of the better and closer examples of that. The tax credit industry is incredibly capital-constrained right now. Investors and community development entities like ours need the flexibility to work on larger deals. The industry as a whole has slowly been lifting the minimum size for transaction beyond the $5 million minimum to higher amounts. If the cap is too small, we run the risk of very limited participation by investors, which will likely result in worse pricing and less benefit to these projects. The model of new market tax credit investment that we tend to focus on is real estate oriented. And by that, they tend to be a little bit larger, and I should probably distinguish between traditional real estate development and how we're engaged in this. A true real estate developer like a Girding and Edlund develops a large project in order to lease it to a third party. And then there's the type of investment where there's a capital expansion of a project. An example would be where a manufacturer is acquiring a building, fitting it out, acquiring equipment and fixtures and so forth, and then perhaps needing some working capital as well. And we finance both of those types of projects. Our company was organized and founded on the principle of creating stronger economic communities for Oregonians through developing new financial tools and added resources. We stand ready to continue that effort through this particular legislation.
Thank you. Can you just give us one of the, I'm actually the one who asked for the smaller cap because mm-hmm. of wanting to increase the use of the credit for small businesses mm-hmm. and specifically to get more jobs into some of these low-income communities. Can you give us kind of the difference between what you get for a $5 million project versus a $10 million, so that we can kind of understand the
policy? Well, there are not many deals to be done at the smaller level, and typically, if you have more of an allocation engaged, you can ask for more community benefit. You can ask for more jobs. You can ask for special interest on loans. You can leverage a range of partners and so forth to come into these projects and do them. We did the African American Museum in New York, and we were only into that for $4 million, and it was a $225 million project. The $4 million that we put in there, we were able to leverage additional jobs, additional considerations for local participation in terms of jobs and so forth for and new businesses to go into that particular project.
Okay. Do you have any comments on that, Danielle or Craig?
I can say again for the record, my name is Danielle Delgadillo with Advantage Capital Partners. Again, this is, as Craig mentioned, this is a policy decision, but we can provide you with projects that we've done in other states where we have matching credits to show you what we've invested, what that's turned out. If that's helpful, it will take a day or so to get those turned around, but we've run the gamut. It's a project by project. In Missouri, for example, typical investment would be about $3.5 million, but we have had some projects that have gone $10 million and above, and we've had some that are much lower. So if it's helpful to provide some real life examples in other states, we're happy to do that. We don't have a position either way.
What I'm trying to get a fix on is the jobs per dollar investment, mm-hmm. basically at the $5 million level versus the $10 million level. I mean, would you get a higher percentage of jobs per million dollars invested at the $10 million level, or would you would that be more concentrated at the $5 million level?
Well, it's not always jobs. It's kind of what the jobs are, and there are other benefits as well. I mentioned the Vanport project. In the Vanport project, the goal there was to have local jobs for the community, was to have local business ownership, and local ownership of the property as an end result of making the investment in that community. So those were three very different markers that we had to use in terms of making that investment in that community, and all those things happened. So the companies that are located in that project, I think there are maybe 10 or 11 of them, they own their own property. They're all local businesses that come out of that community, and they all hire locally.
Madam Chair, if it would be helpful, and I realize you'd prefer to have an answer now, a lot of the challenge in doing a jobs per dollar is that each one of these projects is very unique. Some of them may be a bioengineering firm that has a very small number of very high-salaried people. Another one might be a brick production factory, and where you'd have a large number of folks at a lower rate. So it really depends upon project by project. But at least we can try and see if there isn't anything that sifts out of the data that tells us whether or not there are more likely to be a certain type of investment at the higher number versus the lower number, and whether or not there's any sign of how many people are employed per dollar at the lower level versus the higher level, and see if we can get that to you, if that would be helpful.
Yeah, I think just to point that out, the projects we do are across the board. Some of them are very technically oriented. There's an AIDS center. There are charter schools. There are any number of things. And trying to compare jobs per dollar for one or the other is just very difficult to do. It depends on the size, where they are, and how big the gap is in terms of what they need. This is similar to a number of programs that are run both by the state and essentially by the city of Portland, and it's about filling the gap. You know, is it a worthwhile project? What's the benefit to the community, and how large is it?
And Madam Chair, one other thing I can add is that despite what information we may have now, the bill will require that as investments are made, that they report back to the legislature the number of jobs that are created by each investment, how much salary is provided by those jobs on average, whether they have health care and so forth. So you as a legislature will have a period of time after the initial investments are made to review whether it's going the direction you want. And as long as you make the change before all the investments are made, you'll be able to refocus some of those later investments to make sure they're going where you want to. Mm-hmm. So even if you're not comfortable making a decision now, it's something that you can revisit later after some of the investments have been made within that first 2 years would be my guess. After 4 years, all the investments will have to have been made, but at least you'll have a period where you'll be able to see whether or not the investments are going where you want them to be going.
Okay, thank you. Questions, Senator Morris?
Thank you. I assume that the higher the cap, the fewer the projects. I mean, it's just a math issue. Right. So I would assume that the real estate projects are a higher, as you had indicated, a higher investment cost. And I guess I just wonder if that runs a little bit counter to the intent of this, is to try to spread it out to businesses that are needing to expand or possibly even creation, as opposed to a real estate investment. And I understand the importance of the real estate side of it, too. But maybe if you could comment on...
Well, let me just speak to the real estate. We don't do real estate investment. In other words, there's no, you don't build it and expect them to come. Everything is associated with the businesses. That's why it has to tell a compelling story before. These things are very competitive. For instance, we've got a pipeline of projects now that must be 60 or 70 deep across the country, and we'll only do maybe six or seven of those with the current allocation that we have. We ask those people to fill out a community impacts sheet that talks about jobs, impact to their community, impact to the tax base, all those things. All that is information that we certainly have provided, but are certainly willing to provide again. But the point is that none of this is speculative development as you would think of real estate development. We don't build it and then lease it to a third party. This is about investing in a business, but investing in the real estate portion of that business, which is often a critical part of getting that business up and going. So it may be the land that it's on. It may be a capital investment in equipment, as I mentioned. There's also some working capital that occasionally takes place in that. But we consider the project as a whole.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oops, disappeared. Okay, thank you very much for this update, and we'll stay tuned.
One other thing I'll say is we are available to meet with anyone to deal with further on questions if you have any. We'll great. Make sure that we're available for that.
Has Ryan had his baby yet?
No. We're still waiting.
Still waiting. Okay. I think this is week two of waiting.
We should send him the committee's best regards.
That we will. Thank you.
Okay. Last item. Update on the amnesty program. Well, before we move to that, there wasn't anybody else here who wanted to talk on this, was there? I didn't think so. Okay. Update on the amnesty program from the Department of Revenue.
Good morning, Chair Burdick, members Welcome. Of the committee. Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Just a brief reminder of how your amnesty program worked. You asked us to put in place this program. We started accepting applications October 1st, 2009, and the deadline for filing an application was November 19th, 2009. The returns that are associated with the applications need to be filed by next week, January 19th, 2010. The numbers that I'm going to give you should change in the next few weeks, but so far we've processed 8,500 applications. We've received 5,200 tax returns, and those are made up of rounded individuals filed 4,300 returns, corporations about 325, transit returns accounted for about 500, fiduciary about 100, and about 10 inheritance tax returns. Now again, because they have until January 19th to file the returns, we expect those numbers to go up. In fact, yesterday we sent letters to applicants who had filed for the program but had not yet submitted returns to remind them of that deadline. We sent out over 500 letters to businesses and over 4,700 letters to individuals. So we do expect the number of returns that we've received to go up.
Okay, so you got 5,200 tax returns and 8,500 people have said, have they inquired or have they actually filed for the program?
Madam Chair, 8,500 actually applied. There could be more than 1 year on an application. So
okay.
The application number is a little less informative than it might be.
Okay.
So we're tracking the returns, obviously. Payments that we've received to date, this is cash in the bank. We have just over $20 million. That does not include people who have asked to be put on installment plans, and it obviously doesn't include the returns that we still expect to receive.
So how many, what's your ballpark estimate of what percentage would be on a payment plan?
Madam Chair, we have set up slightly under 200 accounts, and that's made up of about $215,000. But we still have a number of applications to set up on pay plans. We've not focused on that area yet. So that will go up, I believe. And the pay plans have to be paid off by May 31st, 2011, as you recall. I mentioned that we have received $20 million in payments, and at the last hearing, you asked for information about how that broke out for different categories, so I do have that. Individuals have paid $3.5 million. Corporations have paid just under $16 million. The transit program accounts for about $145,000, fiduciary about $63,000, and inheritance about $282,000. And again, those numbers are rounded. And unless you have additional questions, I think that was all the information I wanted to convey. We're happy to come back during the February session with updated numbers once we've got the final returns that we've received. We can update that information too.
So my question to Dr. Werner here is, does this fall within your 2% prediction?
Madam Chair, this exceeds the projection by more than 2%.
But luckily, there's no kicker on amnesty.
So, that's right. I also recall that we did There was, as part of the bill, an allocation of up to $1 million of costs for the department to administer. And, of course, in terms of the kicker, these dollars were put into a separate amnesty fund and are not technically part of the general fund.
So based on what the report we have, this program was a success.
Madam Chair, yes. If you're looking at the dollars, so far we're ahead of what the projection was.
And is there any way you can get some fix on what this is going to mean in terms of the revenue stream of the future now that we have these people in the system?
Madam Chair, that's one of the issues that we've been working on as we get this information in, is to look at the characteristics of the returns, why people may have not filed on time, and see if we can't use that in our work to improve compliance in the future. So it's not just that we're getting the returns and filing them, processing, but we're going to use the information, hopefully, to improve the compliance and reduce that gap.
And then you have additional auditors who've been assigned to step up the efforts to identify people who didn't take advantage of the amnesty. The name Bill Sizemore comes to mind. I couldn't resist, committee.
We do have staff that will be working on that, on non-filer issues and enhanced audit issues.
Great. Senator Hass.
Is there anything in the returns you've received so far to allow you to venture a guess in how much more will come in? Is it $2 million, $5
million? Senator, Chair Burdick, Senator Hass, I don't have that information and would really be hesitant to say how much more revenue might come in the next week attached to those later returns. I just don't have that data.
Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any way to judge why these people haven't filed? I mean,
Chair Burdick, Senator Telfer, that is one of the things that we plan to follow up on, is to send out a survey question to people that participated in the amnesty, allow them to respond anonymously as to, if they choose, why they did not file correctly in the first place. Was it because they missed 1 year and then a second year and then were scared, or is it because they were actively thinking that they weren't ever going to be caught, or what, and see if we can't get some data around to answer that question a little better.
Because I think with that piece of information, that would be helpful in projecting what future revenue streams might come in from these people filing.
And we are looking at that, Chair Burdick, Senator Telfer.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question to Paul. If I'm recalling numbers correctly, this is probably about 6 or 7/10 of 1% of the filing annual filers. Is that pretty close to what you had projected?
The difference, and just the numbers that Deborah gave us, I think the biggest difference is on the split between individual and corporate. The corporate was, based on what we'd seen from other states, we have seen consistently an over proportional participation by corporations, you know, relative to their total collections. But this is even wider than what we had expected. Of course, you know, personal to corporate collections are about 10-1 in terms of the dollar amounts. Yet here you have these collections, it's on basically 4-1 corporations in terms of the dollars that have come in. Now, we'll have to look at that and see how that breaks down. It may have been a few larger payments that came in that may have accounted for that, but that will be an interesting issue, too, to see that breakdown of that $16 million, to see where that came from and what were some of the issues behind those that participation.
Also, it'd be interesting to know how many were people who filed who hadn't filed versus amendments. I suspect a lot of the corporate were amendments.
Madam Chair, I don't have that breakdown, but I do know that there were a number of amended returns as opposed to initial filings for corporations.
Yeah, I'd like to drill a little bit deeper into that one. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you. Well, committee, we did another one, and now we are adjourned.
Yay. 20 million bucks.